All of you, welcome to this week's edition of Insights into the Weekly Parsha. This week's Parsha, we have a double Parsha, Parsha's Matos Masai. We have Chazak, Chazak, Venis Chazek, the end of Sefer Bamidbar. Next week, introducing Sefer Devarim. And of course, as we finish a Parsha, we reflect not only a Parsha, but a Sefer, reflect on all the important lessons, the meaningful Limudim that we have studied over these past many weeks. For those of you who would like to follow along inside in the Art Scroll Stone, Gluchumish, you can find Parshas Matos, page 900 in the Hebrew, page 901 in the English. I'd like to thank our anonymous sponsor this week for sponsoring this Torah class. We appreciate it, the Boca Jewish Center, very much your generosity. This week's class is generously sponsored in honor of our incredible executive director, Matthew Hockerman, who has worked so hard over these many months to provide unbelievable content to be sure that our virtual shul, it's not only up and running, but it is strong and it's with great vitality. So, Matthew, I personally thank you very much. And to our anonymous sponsor, we thank you for your generosity and are really appreciating the incredible work that Matthew has done and does do and provides for our community. We are enormously in debt and grateful to Matthew's service and partnership and the leadership of our Boca Jewish Center community. So, Matthew, this shir is in your honor and in your family's honor this morning. Okay, so let's get started. We know that there is a great amount in Parshas Matos and Masai, the journeys of the Jewish people, the laws of kashrus in Parshas Matos, and so many different dinim, Ari Miklat, the settling, the apportioning of the Nachalas Yisrael into Eretz Yisrael, what's going to be the places where everybody's going to be. But I want to focus our attention on really two main ideas. First of all, the love of Eretz Yisrael. Who's responsible for that love of Eretz Yisrael? And then we'll realize that, as Disney World seems to have it right, in the ride that is still somewhat surprisingly the most popular, it's a small world after all. The small deeds, which seem to be otherwise innocuous or perhaps overlooked, inconspicuous, but it's those small things that make all the incredible difference in the world. When we talk about, first and foremost, the love that somebody has for Eretz Yisrael and the feeling that a person's supposed to have for Eretz Yisrael. So the Briskura, famously, together, in the way I'm going to share this morning, had a very important feeling about Eretz Yisrael, as did many great rabbis, great leaders. But there was a similarity that he shared with Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, as they thought about what their experience was specifically to the mountains, the Swiss Alps. And I just want to share with you, by way of introduction, what each of them said, obviously not together, but what each of them said, and how that highlights a tremendous amount of not only perspective, but love of Eretz Yisrael. So first, Rav Cook. So once, the story is told that Rav Cook, he was once stuck in Switzerland during World War I. When he came back to Eretz Yisrael, so he marveled at the sight of the Judean mountains as he was ascending into Yerushalayim. You know, when you're either on Route 1 and you're going, ascending into Yerushalayim, you have that feeling, the heart thump and the palpitation of excitement. You're really enthusiastic. So he was ascending into Yerushalayim. So one of his Talmidim, one of his students said that he was marveling at the sights of the Judean mountains. He said, Rebbe, we just saw the Swiss Alps. Like, what could be so exciting? I mean, it's exciting, but he said, you know, it's said to be the most beautiful, mountains in the world. So there, sort of, Cook said to him, the Alps didn't speak to me. They didn't talk to my heart. The mountains of Yehuda, the mountains of Eitzel, they do because they are mine. It's just the understanding, the realization that the mountains, the land, it is the land of the Jewish people. It is our homeland, and it behooves us to appreciate how significant, how much it means to us. That's number one. The second is the Brisker Rav, and this is, I think, also a very powerful perspective and just another way of thinking about just even beautiful things that you look at. The Brisker Rav also, he was once asked about his impressions of the mountains and the views of what he saw and what he experienced, what he witnessed while he was away in Switzerland. He saw the Swiss Alps. So he said, this is unbelievable. He said, this is the beauty of Eretz Yisrael in Golus, in exile in Switzerland. Meaning, it's beautiful. It's spectacular. You know what the spectacular beauty is? It's Eretz Yisrael's beauty. It's just in Golus. It's just in exile. So an incredible impression, a perspective. When you think about even things that you look at that are beautiful, it's Eretz Yisrael. Be able to see the beauty and the holiness and the Kedusha of Jerusalem, the city of gold, Eretz Yisrael, Eretzenu HaKadosh Admas Kodesh, to be able to see that. And that's what's going to frame really our conversation, what we're going to hopefully reinvigorate, to feel inspired more so, to appreciate we are the ones who are the vanguard, the supervisors, the shoinrim, to appreciate what it means to love Eretz Yisrael. So let's begin. We know that in Parshas Matos, the first of the two Parshas that we are going to lay in this coming Shabbos, that we're going to read this upcoming Shabbat, we read of an unusual request. Everything seems to be going fairly well. Now they're going to go into Eretz Yisrael after there's been punishment after punishment. We know that the whole purpose of their being freed from their years of slavery and the bondage, 200 years of shackles of servitude, now they're going to go to the promised land. They're going to go to Eretz Yisrael. They're traveling years in the desert with a couple short stops on the way that were unanticipated, unplanned. There's complaining, there's pirud, there's machlokes, so on and so forth. But now they're going to go to Eretz Yisrael, and we're going to now discuss nachala. What's nachala? We're going to discuss the apportioning of the various tribes. They're going to be in this portion, you're going to be in that portion. But Mimonoshach, we're going to be excited about the fact that Eretz Yisrael is now, it's in our, on the horizon, it's in our hands. We're now going to enter into the Holy Land, and we're going to live there, we're going to dwell there. But that's why this unusual request that happens in Parshas Matos, which gives us pause, gives us a bit to reflect upon and to think about what that means even in our own time, is this unusual request that's made by the Shvatim, the tribes of Reuven and the tribe of Gad. So what happened? So they approached Moshe Rabbeinu and they asked, after they're seeing the land that they appreciate, that was okay, they're going to go to Eretz Yisrael, that people are going to go to Eretz Yisrael, but on the Transjordanian side, and they asked Moshe Rabbeinu if they could permanently reside in the territory east of the Jordan River. So that's like an extraordinary request. It seems like, are you serious? Are you kidding me? What's going to be? We know, of course, that Bnei Yisrael had captured the region from the kingdoms of Sichon and Og. And then Reuven and Gad, they decided that the lush pastures in this region, it suited them well. Why? Because as the Chumash tells us, they have very large herds of cattle, and they wanted to be able to have their herds of cattle have an expanse, have land, and so therefore asked permission to settle into this region rather than live together with the other Shvatim, with the other tribes of Eretz. That's what the Pasuk tells us. If it pleases you, and this is the request that they made to Moshe Rabbeinu, if this pleases you, please give this land. Let this be for your servants, Moshe Rabbeinu. Let us stay here. This will be our nachla. This will be our heritage. And do not take us. And do not take us across the Jordan to Eretz Yisrael. So Moshe Rabbeinu, of course, obviously, is initially very angered by this request of Reuven and Gad. Like, how could you possibly ask such a thing? Are you not aware of like recent history? Do you not realize what happens when you melt the hearts of the people? Are you not aware of what happens when you institute the idea and you introduce the concept of there's something missing and minuscule about Eretz Yisrael? There's something that's not ideal about Eretz Yisrael. You know what you do to the people? You know what happens to the people? You know what the result of that is? Did you not know the story of Parsha Shlach Lecha Anoshim? Like, what's the story? These are not people that you do not know, that you weren't aware of. These weren't family members. This is not like time of antiquity. This is like recent history. This is modern Jewish history, like real recent history to these people. So Moshe Rabbeinu is very angry. What does he say? V'yom Ramosha livnei Gad v'livnei Reuven. Achechem yovo la'milchama v'atem teshufo. Like, he's like, it's extraordinary to him. He's like, you can't believe it. What's going to be? Are you serious? That the descendants of Gad and Reuven, what's going to be? He says to them, shall your brothers, shall your sisters, shall your mishpachis, should they go to Milchama, should they go into the land of Eretz Yisrael, battle what they're going to have to battle without you? You're going to stay here and you're going to have it cozy and it's going to be all royal and rosy and everything's going to be nice and relaxed and in your plush pastures that you're going to stay. Are you kidding me? Are you serious? What's going to be? Why is it? He says, Lama Taniyun, es leiv b'nei Yisrael ma'avar es ha'aretz asher nasa lehem Hashem. Why is it that you discourage the Jewish people? Why are you telling Bnei Yisrael that they shouldn't cross over to the land? Obviously, you're not going to tell them that directly, so it seems. But even you're staying here. Like, what's wrong with Eretz Yisrael? Somebody decides they're going to stay back and they're not going to go to this place that's been the whole purpose of which we left Mitzrayim. We're going to go into Eretz Yisrael, and now you guys are going to choose to stay back. Like, and you're going to now melt the hearts, discourage the hearts of Bnei Yisrael. Are you serious? This is exactly ki osav v'seichem. This is exactly what happened when I sent the shluchim, when I sent the messengers. These weren't just like slouchy men. These were like men of great reputation. These were men of great leadership. I sent them from Kadesh Barnea to Koa to Eretz Yisrael. Like, do you not remember like what happens? And he asks them very strongly and very finger-waggingly, like, are you kidding me? Like, seriously, we're going to go through this again? Did you not understand? Did you not experience? Do you not see what happened around you? Why? Moshe Rabbeinu is like scratching his head, pulling out his beard hair. He's like, unbelievable. You have to be kidding me. So after this initial request, and after Moshe Rabbeinu wags his finger, points back at him, pushes back at them, and he questions the initial request, of course we know that he later acquiesced you know, once they express their intent to join the other tribes, no, that's not what we're expecting to do. We're not going to leave them alone. We're not going to stay back here while they're conquering Eretz Yisrael. There's going to be a war to capture it. So we're not going to do that. So after he hears their response, so then he was willing to acquiesce to their to what their request is. V'anachnu echolek chushin lifnei b'nei Yisrael ad asher im avionum el makayim v'yoshev tapenu me'arev mitzav mipnei yoshvei ha'aretz. No. You know what's going to happen? We're going to arm ourselves. We're going to raise arms in battle together with our brothers and sisters. Not only that, we're going to go before them. We're going to be first in line. We're going to make sure that they're brought to their place. They're going to be settled. Everyone's going to be tucked into their places nice and safely. Our children will reside in the fortified cities on account of the inhabitants of the land. And not only that, and this is where he finally was willing to let them go, lo noshuv el batenu, we will not return back to our homes where on Transjordan side into the nachla that you're going to hopefully let us have. We're not going to lo noshuv el batenu ad his nachel. B'nai Yisrael ish nachalosa. We're not going to go back to our homes until every single person of B'nai Yisrael, every single person in the tribes of the Jewish people has taken possession of their inheritance. We're going to be part of the celebration. We're going to be part of the settling. We're going to be part of the milchama that's going to be Nachlas Yisrael and Eretz Kanan and Arzenu HaKadosha. No problem, says Moshe Rabbeinu. If in fact you're willing, ready, and able to do that, so then I'm willing to acquiesce. I'm willing to make your request. A request that's going to be okay. Now, here's what's surprising. Not only is there just this request, not only, of course, the response, and then what they're willing to do, and then Moshe Rabbeinu says, okay, if that's what you're going to do, it's not going to melt the heart of the people. Everything's going to be Shalom al Yisrael. Fine, good and dandy, but here's what's surprising. But what's surprising, at the end of the story, we see that now, it's not just Reuven and Gad that are going to be given this request permissibility to now settle into this land. But at the end of the story, there's a third tribe that famously, of course, we all know, that suddenly enters into the picture. It's this third tribe that suddenly enters the picture. The Pasuk tells us in Perek Lamed Beis, Pasuk Lamed Gimel, chapter 32, verse 33, that Moshe Rabbeinu also grants this region east of the Jordan River to the tribes not only of Reuven and Gad, but also to Chatzi Shevet Menashe, also the half of the tribe of Menashe. Now here's what's problematic is, number one is, why is the Moshe Rabbeinu chooses to introduce Menashe? Why Chatzi Shevet Menashe? And third, but maybe most importantly, is Menashe doesn't even request that. Menashe is not even interested in that. They weren't part of the initial quest, you know, to have their Nachla be not in Eretz Yisrael. So maybe if you were part of the tribe of Menashe that was told, you got a letter in the mail, you get an email, you get some snail mail, you get told that, hey, by the way, the place that you're planning to go into Eretz Kanaan, nice, but that's not what's happening. What's happening is now you're going to go to have to stay on the Transjordan side. Like, how would you feel? What's the responsibility? Like, why'd that happen? There's no indication that they were even interested. Here they're introduced by Moshe Rabbeinu, that's what's going to happen. And it's not just that it's going to be the whole tribe, but now it's going to be the half tribe. That's what the Pasuk tells us in Pasuk Lamed Gimel Vayitein, Lohem Moshe, Livnei Gad, Livnei Reuven, Vilachatzi Shevet Menashe. Good, Moshe Rabbeinu is willing to let them have the request. Gad, Reuven. And now he introduces Chatzi Shevet Menashe ben Yosef, Es Memleches Sichon Melecha, and Moriv Es Memleches Oig Melech Haboshon Haaretz, Lehorea Begvules Ore Haaretz Saviv. And this is what he's willing to let them have, the land where the Amora, the Melech HaBoshan, Melech Sichon, that they were conquered. And look, this is the land that's going to be, this surrounding territory, what's going to happen, that's what they're going to get. So of course, this question, as we just said, so why Chatzi Shevet Menashe, why half of the tribe of Menashe, why would they part of this if the request was only made by Reuven and Gad? So here's what I want to share with you, a very important lesson, part one. Part one answer is this. And this is shared by the Mefarshim, by the commentaries, a beautiful idea. The answer is that there's something that emerges from a story. And the story that emerges is a story that's told not in this week's Parshios, but it's part of what emerges from a story in last week's Parsha, in Parshas Pinchas. If you'll remember, in Parshas Pinchas, there's a request that's made by the daughters of Tzelophchad, Benos Tzelophchad, the story of Tzelophchad. So here, there we read about the five daughters of Tzelophchad. Now, who was Tzelophchad? Tzelophchad was a man who died in the Midbar. He died in the wilderness, as the Pasuk tells us, on his own averus. He wasn't a renegade. He wasn't a complainer. He wasn't on the side of Korach. No, he was a man who died of just his sins like every person would die. So he died of his sins, and he left five daughters, no sons. Famously, of course, we all know. The five daughters, they come to Moshe Rabbeinu, and they ask for the right to receive their father's portion in Eretz Yisrael. They want to go to Eretz Yisrael. They want to have their nachla. Why should they be deprived? because of the fact that they had no brothers, because of the fact that they are women, because they're daughters, like, why should they have no nachla? That was their complaint. So Hashem spoke, you know, then spoke to Moshe Rabbeinu and affirmed that the request was a legitimate request. After Moshe says, listen, benos tzalavcha, like, what am I supposed to do? I don't know the answer to this question. Let's speak to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I'm going to ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God Almighty, like, what the answer is. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu then goes back, tells Moshe Rabbeinu that their request is a good request, it was legitimate, and that the benos tzalavcha, the daughters of tzalavcha, they rightfully deserved the portion that was to have been granted to their fathers. The Pasuk tells us, Perek Chav Zayin, Pasuk Zayin, Kein benos tzalavcha, Daivra, so says the Kadosh Baruch Hu, that the benos tzalavcha have spoken correctly, they've spoken justly. That they spoke correctly, you should give them a portion in inheritance along with their father's brothers. They should have a nachla in Eretz Yisrael. You should transfer their father's inheritance to them. The nachlas of avihem should be theirs. Lohen. So they were right. So the question is, like, what is it that this story has anything to do with the half a tribe of Manasseh that's thrown into this equation with the request of Reuven and Gad? So Rashi writes that when the Torah introduces Tzalavcha's daughters, it's very important that the introducing of Benos Tzalavcha happens in chapter 27, Pasuk Aleph, Perek Chaf Zayin, Pasuk Aleph. So it tells us the lineage, and it's not unfamiliar that we learn the lineage of various personalities. Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron, a Kohen, right? We've known that the lineage was drawn to Yaakov Avinu in many instances. We know that sometimes we draw even past the grandparents, it's the great-grandparents, but here's what's interesting, that when you draw the lineage, you know, when you call somebody to the Torah, for example, it's this person, ben that person, right? But you don't call the next generation. What happens when you call the next generation in Chumash or the next generation? Of course, you're trying to be, you know, a transmission of some type of lesson. What is that we learn from that person? Who is it that we derive this type of limud, this drasha from? So Rashi writes, and when the Torah first introduces in Perek Chav Zayin, Pasuk Aleph 27:1, he introduces Benos Tzalavchad. See, so the Torah tells us that they belonged to the tribe of Manasseh. Okay, we have to learn the lineage, we have to link the chain, that they became from Shevet Manasseh. Okay, so you think that that's like the end of the story, so maybe that's the link between Shevet Manasseh and the Benos Tzalavchad. But then there's something else. What the Torah says then, and it also emphasizes not just that the lineage ends with Manasseh, but the Torah tells us that the lineage extends by also identifying who Manasseh's father was. Who was Manasseh's father? That's right. His father was Yosef HaTzadik. It says, and it emphasizes that Manasseh was the son of Yosef. As the Pasuk says in Perek Chav Zayin, Pasuk Aleph, Vatikravna benos Tzalavchad ben Chefer ben Gilad ben Mocher ben Manasseh, should end there, the Mishpachas Menasha ben Yosef, that the daughters of Tzalavchad, who were the son of Chefer, the son of Gilead, the son of Mochir, the son of Menasha, the families of Menasha were the sons of Yosef. And they came forward. The Elishmos ben Yosef, Mochla, Noya, Vechogla, Milka, etc. They came forward and they make their request. Now, of course, we already know who Menasha's father was. If you just simply say that this is, you know, Benos Tzalavchad, Chefer, Gilad, Mochir, Manasseh, you've already gone back quite a number of generations, right? Maybe the whole purpose is just to get back to Manasseh. So once we've gotten to Manasseh, we don't need to know who Yosef is. We already know that Manasseh is the son, Ephraim and Manasseh, right? We give blessings to our sons each Friday night. We know that these are the sons of Yosef. We're not learning something that's like brand spanking new. We know something that we're being told, something we've been told for a long time. So why is it, once we're drawing the lineage down so far, bring it to Menasha? So Zol Zayin Gezunt and Stark Zayin Mazel and Bracha. Why do you have to now then tell me that Menasha is the son of Yosef? Of course, we're already familiar with Menasha, and there seems, thus at first glance, I mean, no reason the Torah is going to identify him as Yosef's son. So why does the Torah do that? So here's the commentary of Rashi. Rashi tells us here's the reason. And this is very, very important. Rashi explains, Mishpachas Menasseh ben Yosef, Lama Nemar. Rashi says, why is it necessary? Why would we have to say this? Our questions, not my questions. Rashi's question, it's Chazal's question. Was it not said, Valokfar Nemar ben Menasseh? What's it already says ben Menasseh? According to Rashi, and the kasha, the question he's asking, is that would have been sufficient. That would have been suffice. That would have been enough. Why do we have to draw one more? Elo Lamer. So why do we have to draw one more generation? Here's the answer. You know why? It's to tell us that Yosef HaTzadik, he was chayvev, he had a chavivus es haaretz, he cherished, he was very much in love with Eretz Yisrael. He cherished Eretz Yisrael. How do you know? Shenamar, as the Pasuk says in Bereishis, where the Pasuk says, Valisames Atzmoisai, noting that at the end of his life he's going to be buried in Mitzrayim, he then adjured to that his bones should be taken up out of Eretz Mitzrayim and they should be brought to Eretz Yisrael. He cherished Eretz so much. Don't leave my bones there. Bring my bones, bring my human remains, bring me to Eretz Yisrael. That makes it, as Rashi says, that Eretz Yisrael is chaviv. Like it was beloved and cherished to him. That's Yosef. What does that have to do with the Benos Tzlavchon? So Rashi says, here's the link. Uvenoisav chavvu es haaretz. That Tzlavcha's daughters also loved Eretz Yisrael. They also cherished it. So how do we know? Because the Pasuk says, Tnu lanu achuza. Give us our achuza. Give us a portion. So say the Benos Tzlavchon, why should we be left out? We are not looking just for monetary gain. We're not looking for agricultural space. We're not just looking for an inheritance, just stam an inheritance. Rashi is explaining the link between identifying her great-great-great-grandfather as Yosef, because he had a love for it. So you know why? Why that matters? Because the Benos Tzlavchon, with their request to go into Eretz Yisrael, they didn't want to just stam. They wanted it because they loved Eretz Yisrael. They wanted to be part of the narrative of the Jewish people. They wanted to have a nachla, a portion in Eretz Canaan, and a portion in Eretz Yisrael because it was chaviv. It was chavivu es haaretz. They beloved. It was beloved. It was cherished to them. They loved Eretz Yisrael, and therefore they wanted to be there. As Yosef Atzadik wanted to be there, so too the Benos Tzlavchon wanted to be there as well. He wanted his bones to be there. They wanted to have their nachla there, linking that chain. What it is. Is therefore we understand why the Torah then mentions Yosef. They both had a tremendous love. And that's what Rashi explains, that the Torah here is emphasizing the relationship between Tzlavchad's daughters and Yosef at Tzadik, really to allude to us that they both shared a genuine love and an affinity for Eretz Yisrael. So though, right? Because Yosef, he made his brothers swear, and as we just said, that the Atzmoisai and her love and their love, Benos Tzlavchad, to go into Eretz Yisrael. So therefore, that's this association of Benos Tzlavchad, Yosef, that they all loved and cherished Eretz Yisrael like Benos Tzlavchad, like Yosef. Good. So that is the link. Now this sheds, perhaps, I would suggest, some light on Menashe's entry into the story. Why is he given this portion? Why does Moshe Rabbeinu then choose to give Menashe, Chatzi Shevet Menashe, a part of Menashe to this story? Here's the answer. And the answer is this, and it's so important for all of us, because here we live in, for those, many of us, certainly in our community, here in the diaspora, here in Golis, here in Chutz La'aretz, and even that we're in Golis, those who have the zechus to live in Eretz Yisrael, the merit to live in Eretz Yisrael, the tremendous privilege to live in Eretz Yisrael. But this is an important lesson. You see, Reuven, the Mefarshim commentaries explain that Reuven and God's request, yes, it's true that it was ultimately granted. Yes, their wish was ultimately given to them. But the Mefarshim point out that through their request and ultimately their decision to remain outside of Eretz Yisrael, it reflected something. What did it reflect? It reflected a deficiency in their connection to Eretz Yisrael. Doesn't mean they didn't love Eretz Yisrael. It didn't mean that they didn't want to ultimately maybe be in Eretz Yisrael, but maybe they didn't. Maybe what it does mean is that there's a connection to Eretz Yisrael which is diminished. There's something that was lacking. There was something that was deficient. Because when you have a heartache and a desire to really mamish, want to be in Eretz Yisrael, to do anything for that matter, the Gemara says, "Bederech Shadam Reitzav, Kadosh Baruch Hu Molichan Oisai," the place that a person wants to be, Kadosh Baruch Hu gets them there. A person is brought and driven to that place. So if a person has such a desire, such a rason, such a chavivos to be in Eretz Yisrael, so they would be there. And therefore, the Mefarshim explained that maybe what was lacking is there's a little bit of deficiency, there's some connection to Eretz Yisrael that's lost. That their preference to settle across the river to accommodate their herds indicated that they did not sufficiently appreciate the special sanctity, the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael. Right? That's also found in not even just the idea in general, but even Bifrat. Even the specifics of the request. What does the Pasuk say? And Moshe Rabbeinu obviously later on quickly changes their request. Vayikshu Elav. When they come to Moshe Rabbeinu, they come close and they make the following request. Vayomru Gidrois Tzai Nivne L'miknenu Pai V'orim L'tapenu. You know what we're going to do? We're going to build, sheepfolds for our livestock here in this place, and we're going to build cities for our tapenu, for our youngsters, for our children. Moshe Rabbeinu says, after he acquiesced and he tells them, you can go, he says, first of all, let me make something very clear. First, you take care of the needs of your children. First, you build houses and you shelter your family, your human children. And then afterwards, you want to build sheepfolds of surplus of, you know, boundary for your cattle, no problem, for your livestock. Good, go for it. But first, you're going to request a place for your livestock, a place then for your tapenu. That's not the right thing. So maybe what that means, even just by the very request, is they're focused on their physicality, they're focused on their gidros tzayin, they're focused on their flock, on their sheep, their cattle, their livestock. Maybe what that means is there's a certain kedusha of Eretz Yisrael that they like overlooked clearly. Now maybe they just saw this expanse, they want to just be there. That's one obvious possibility, but there's something deeper than that. They maybe were lacking an appreciation and a connection to Eretz Yisrael. What is Eretz Yisrael? Eretz Yisrael is where, as the Gemara Maseches Tainis tells us, the nourishment, the parnasa, the kedusha, the holiness, it comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, from Almighty God, b'chvodo uva'atzmo. In Chutz La'aretz, all the nourishment, the rains, Yimei Geshamim, the parnasa, that comes from Yimei Shluchim, that comes from the hands, Yimei Shluchim, from Hashem's, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's messengers. There's a direct hashras hashchina. There's a direct connection to the divine. Atzeinu HaKadosha Admas Kodesh, the land of Israel, is cherished to us. Failing to appreciate the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael is something we can never, ever, ever take lightly. We can never get to a place where we're comfortable, we're complacent, and this is appropriate for the 3 weeks, the time we're mourning the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. It's not just an edifice, a temple, a building that was and needs to restand. What it represents, the divine that's going to have its emanating in a very strong way, the holiness of the land that's there, the whole the upheaval of Golis, which it's caught in the wake of what it's caused, it comes to its surrender. What happens in Eretz Yisrael when there's going to be Gilui Shechina? It's unbelievable, the holiness, the Kedusha. And even now, while we're in exile, you go to Eretz Yisrael, you come back, you're on fire. You see Balei Tshuva, they go on Birthright, they go on, you know, missions, JWRP, with the most talented, unbelievable Lori Palatnik and her great, incredible program. You go on these missions, you go on these trips, you just go to the Western Wall, you daven, you meet a tzaddik, you even eat in the restaurants, you walk Machane, the Shuk Machane Yehuda, you walk in the Shuk Mei Sharam, you walk around town, you just feel like, you talk to soldiers, you just feel uplifted, you feel the Kiddush, you feel the holiness. So that's what maybe they were lacking. So therefore, Moshe Rabbeinu makes a game day decision. He doesn't even necessarily consult with Shevet Menashe. It doesn't say that he doesn't, but we're not even sure that he does. Who says that he does? He makes a decision. What's he decide to do? He decides to have the people of Menashe, the tribe of Tzelofcha's daughters, reside in the eastern territory together with Reuven and Gad. You know why? Because this was going to be the Shomrim, the group of the people that were going to safeguard. This was done to help infuse these two tribes with a genuine love of Eretz Yisrael that they were clearly lacking. These were the Malamdim. This was like the Sherut Lumi, Lahavdil. These are those Shaluchim, the Shaliach that was sent. The first Shaluchim that were sent to teach a love of Eretz Yisrael were the ones from Shevet Menashe. They go to teach and to be inspiring to the Shevet of Reuven and Gad to say that this is Eretz Yisrael. You know where we come from. We love Eretz Yisrael. Our father Yosef loved Eretz Yisrael. There's a chavivus who's in my soul, who's in my heart, it's in my DNA, it's the makeup of who I am. So they were brought by Moshe Rabbeinu to be the Malamdim. Those are the ones that are going to teach Eretz Yisrael. And I think this is a very important lesson, first lesson of the morning, is that number one, is we have to be sure that we're surrounded by people who are espousing the love of Eretz Yisrael. You see, when you're taught by somebody who loves Eretz Yisrael, is teaching about Torah Eretz Yisrael, is teaching about the Kedushas Eretz Yisrael, the Mokim that's Kadosh, so then it resonates. It rubs off on you. That's number one. But number two is you yourselves have to realize that even though we are in Gullus, even though we're in exile, we can never get too comfortable in exile. We ourselves have to always have our eyes on the prize. We have to always remember that where we are today in Chutz La'aretz is not where we ultimately want to be tomorrow in Eretz Yisrael. We have to constantly yearn for, we have to always struggle. When is it that it's the right time for me to go to Eretz Yisrael? No one should ever get so comfortable that they stop thinking about when it's going to be the right time for them to move to Eretz Yisrael. And that's not something that anybody should be embarrassed about. It's not something that anybody should feel threatened by. Sure, people live in Chutz La'aretz for specific reasons. You have Parnassah, you have Mishpacha, reasons that, of course, are given by Chazal as appropriate and okay. That said, a person should always have an eye on the prize. Should also always be thinking about when's my next trip to Eretz Yisrael? Before I even land from my trip to Eretz Yisrael, I'm already discussing with my wife and children, like, when are we going again? When's the next trip? When are we going? Why? Because it's not just a vacation. You go on vacation to Florida. You go on vacation to the Adirondacks. You go on vacation to, you know, to the Swiss Alps. But you're not going to go on vacation to Eretz Yisrael. You're going home to Eretz Yisrael. You're visiting home when you go back to Eretz Yisrael. So therefore, we have to always infuse ourselves, like the tribes of Reuven and God needed to be infused with the Kedushas, Eretz Yisrael, from Chatzi Shevet Menashe. So then also, we have to also be sure that we are doing the same for ourselves. And we're doing the same for others. But Mokum Shein Ishi, Shtadol Yos Ish, says the Mishnah Pergamum is in the place where there's nobody doing that. So you have to do that yourself. You have to share articles and share inspirational Divrei Torah. You have to share thoughts and theology about what Eretz Yisrael is and why it's so special for those people who are usually able to go, for example, high holidays, Yom Narayim, Sukkot, Pesach, Shavuos, to Eretz Yisrael. They're those that have homes in Eretz Yisrael. They're not able to, for example, this year, to go to Eretz Yisrael, Yom Narayim, Yom Tovim. Share with your family, like, what that's going to be like. Sure, you're going to make the best of it in Chutz La'aretz, and you're certainly going to be uplifted and inspired where you're going to be, but to have Sukkot in Yerushalayim, oh my goodness, not to have Sukkot in Yerushalayim. How could I not have Sukkot in Yerushalayim? How could I not have Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur? So to have Eretz Yisrael is part of, like, how you talk and how you breathe and how you think and what you plan and what's going to direct you in your life. That's going to be lacking. Don't let that happen. That's what the lesson of Moshe Rabbeinu is saying here. Menashe, go along for the ride. You're the Malamdim, you're the Rebbe's, you're the Moras, you're the teachers. You got to teach them about Eretz Yisrael. That's the curriculum that you're going to make sure that is strong and is intact to be sure that Eretz Yisrael is first and foremost. So that's lesson number one. The question, however, remains. And the question that remains, though, is why did Moshe Rabbeinu instruct only half of Shevet Menashe? And this is going to be the second point. That's going to be, it's a small world after all. The lesson of, like, the deeds that you do, you might think it's innocuous and conspicuous, under the radar, not so powerful, not so demonstrative. So this is a very important question we have to answer, which is, why only half? You know, imagine, like, you're part of Shevet Menashe. Was there a lottery? Was there a poor? Was there a goral? Like, how do we decide? What was Moshe Rabbeinu thinking? Why did that happen? Why didn't he simply have all of Menashe live in the region together with Reuven and God? Certainly, if we know that that's who they were, what they represented, so clearly, maybe they'd be able to spread out the expanse of that, the lessons of that, maybe even greater. So here's something that I want to share with you, very important, Chazal. So Chazal tell us, the rabbis teach us, Chachameinu Zichronu Livracha, that's what Chazal stands for, explains that the division of Shevet Menashe was actually a punishment. There's Schar and there's Onesh, and this was an Onesh. It was a punishment of sorts. We don't know the level of it and the intensity of it, but it seems to be that there's some level of punishment, Chazal tell us, for an act, for a deed that was done, committed by the founder of this tribe. Who's the founder of the tribe? Of course, Menashe himself. So many years earlier, we know the story. Yosef HaTzadik is the second in command in all of Eretz Mitzrayim, all of the land of Egypt, providing for the world, providing ultimately for his family. His brothers come from Eretz Yisrael to purchase grain. Of course, we're all familiar with the story. They come to Mitzrayim, the whole concealing of identity, and ultimately then the revealing. But before the revealing, what happens? Like, the drama is taking place. The story is unfolding. Yosef orders his avoda, his servants, to place the royal goblet in the suitcase and the luggage of his youngest brother, Binyamin. They shared the same mother, of course, we all know, Binyamin. And then, after they leave Mitzrayim, so Yosef then sent his son Menashe, who was his servant, who was his attendant, rather, who was his right-hand man, yeah? Menashe was his, wingman. So he sends Menashe to run after them. Menashe was the one who brought them the news, by the way. He's the one who accuses them of thievery. So they're thinking to themselves, like, thievery, are you kidding me? Like, we didn't, steal anything. The goblet, we would never do such a thing. Outrageous, the indictment. Even that you're wagging fever of accusing us of thievery, no way. And sure enough, after they say, you know what? You're so sure of it? If you're so sure of it, search our bags. So Menashe does exactly that. He searches their bags. They put their rucksacks bags down. And sure enough, they find Yosef's goblet, the royal king's goblet, in Binyamin's bag. Now, what happens? So they realize that they had been framed, and now they realize that they're going to be severely punished. So they realize what they're facing. What happens? What is their first reaction after they realized what took place, that they were framed, that there's something that's min shamayim, there's something they have to deal with, they're going to be severely punished, maybe they're going to be slaves le'lamavoyed in Mitzrayim. What do they do? What's their first act? So the Torah tells us that the brothers, they tore their garments as a sign of mourning, as a sign of avelus. Though later, Rahman al-Islam, when a person's an avel, when a person's mourning the loss of a deceased family member, they tear a garment. That's what the Pasuk tells us in Bereshis Perek, chapter 44, Pasuk Yud Gimel, verse number 13. Vayikru simloisam vayamos ish al chamoya v'yashuvu ha'ira. Pasuk tells us that right after this, they rent their garments. They loaded again their donkeys. They go back to the city of Yosef, not knowing that it's Yosef. And of course, the rest of the story takes place as it is. So what does that have to do with anything? So Chazal tells us something important. Chazal tells us that it was Menashe who caused his uncles to tear their garments. It was decreed because of the fact that Menashe was the one who caused his uncles to cause them to tear their garments. The Gezeirah, the decree was that his shevet, that his tribe would be torn into two segments as well, each residing in a different territory. And this is why only half of the tribe of Menashe settles on the eastern side of the Jordan River together with Chatzi, with the tribe of Reuven and Gad. Imagine that. If you think about that for a minute, because of the fact that he was the facilitator of a garment that gets torn by the uncles, that he doesn't even realize the extent of and the far-reaching repercussions of every action that he did, that action then, and the actions that other people, that everybody does, imagine what happens causing their garments to tear. They didn't even know that he was the nephew. So then that would mean that the Gezeirah was, Chazal, the rabbis tell us, that causing their garments to tear was not just left into cyberspace. It was something that was then a Gezeirah, there was then a decree that was established that was now going to be visited upon him, that his tribe was going to be then cut in half. One on this side and one on that side. That's why Moshe Rabbeinu, even though it would seem to be more logical that yes, with the first lesson that he's going to send, the shomrim of an oyhev Yisrael, an oyhev avas is Eretz Yisrael, send the whole tribe. No, the gzeir was that he shouldn't send the whole tribe, but rather he would send the half of the tribe, Chatzi Shevet Menashe. And this is a very, very powerful lesson. Two last final thoughts. Because what we understand here is what this demonstrates with this limud, with this lesson, is the very far-reaching repercussions of each action, of every action that we do. The things that we do, the things actually that we don't do, the things that we say, the things that we don't say. You know, there's so many people in life at the end of their lives or even throughout their lives, they realize like, why didn't I just say what I felt to that person more? Don't ever regret not saying I love you enough or giving enough hugs and kisses to your children or grandchildren, telling your spouse how much you appreciate them, a friend, how much you cherish them, how much that person means. It's not just the things that you say, that's obvious. What about the things that you don't say? What are the things he left out? What about the things he didn't do? What about at the end of, you know, your days when you realize, like, I really had the opportunity or could have made the opportunity to do X, Y, or Z, the things I didn't do. But all achas kama v'kama, all the more so, when there are things that a person does and doesn't realize how far-reaching the repercussions of that. When you speak ill of somebody, when you are disparaging of somebody, when you ostracize somebody, when you espouse negativity about somebody or something, you know what you do? You plant seeds in the ground that just do not vanquish. They do not just evaporate. They do not just disappear. They sprout. They remain. They promulgate. They bring a terrible vicissitude of negativity to the world that maybe in ways we didn't even realize. What happens even if a person does tshuva, repents, but even if that person doesn't know? When you speak, for example, lashon hara, ill speak of somebody, you spoke in the company of other people even though you repented, so you have no idea how far reaching what it is you said, how far it went, how far it has gone, how far it traveled. It has legs, it has eyes, it has ears, it goes and it travels. The things that we do, how far reaching. You think that Menashe, he knew that by just simply causing, being an ambassador, an emissary, he's the wingman of Yosef, he tells them the news, but because of what he does. It's thus that which causes his tribe to be split in half. You think that Manasseh had any idea of that? No way he had an idea of that. And sometimes what I would say, we have no way an idea of the things that we do, the things that we don't do, and how far-reaching the repercussions, the damage, the inability, the segregation, the fracturing that happens as a result of the things we say, the things we don't say, the things we do, the things we don't do. Manasseh's act causing his uncles the amount of stress, the distress that caused them to tear their garment, so it yielded huge consequences. It yielded huge realities, not just for the day, but for centuries that would follow. You see, we never know how seemingly small things, small decisions, words, actions, deeds, how much it's going to affect our lives and the lives of our children, grandchildren, future descendants. We just have no idea. We have no idea what that's going to mean. The story of Manasseh here, what it does, it reminds us of the need to live with a keen sense of responsibility. Be so careful, so scrupulous with what comes out of our mouths, to carefully calculate, to carefully consider every single action, to ensure that the long-term outcome of what it is that we do, it's going to be positive. Now, obviously, you never know how it's all going to play itself out, but we can play our small, and dare I say, large, huge role in what's going to be the long-term outcome. Because we're investing in our children, we're investing in our grandchildren, we're investing in our communities, we're investing in the world. Make your voice loud. Make it so that what you do leaves an impression of positivity in the world. You cannot imagine the length, the width, the breadth of what it is that a person can do. What the long-term outcome will be positive and beneficial for ourselves and for our derivatives, for our generations that are going to follow. Taking that responsibility, realizing how far-reaching, what Manasseh realized only perhaps later, the reality of splitting his tribe in half because of what happened so many centuries earlier. There's a love of Eretz Yisrael. That's what Manasseh is. But there's this duality of understanding and this very important lesson of the responsibility of now being those who espouse Ahavas Eretz Yisrael, but also realizing that as we learn from Manasseh, from Yosef, the love, Benoset Salavcha, the love, but also we realize that there's repercussions and serious ones to the things we do, things we say, things we don't do, things we don't say. And I just want to end this Torah talk with sharing with you an example of how we see unbelievable positive results of what happens when you're a little bit creative or when you're a little bit in pause. When you contemplate, when you just think before you talk, when you perhaps think about maybe nuanced ways of doing things, how far-reaching the things we do and how far-reaching the things we say. So I just want to share with you, there's one of the great books that I've read. It's a book by Greg McKeown. Name of the book is Essentialism. I've spoken about it a number of times. I know many of you are on this talk, listening in the Zoom room. And on Facebook Live, I've heard me talk many times about this book, Essentialism. Greg McKeown. If you've never read the book, you got to get the book. It's easy to get it. Go on Amazon. You'll have it by tomorrow, I'm sure. If you have read it, you know what I'm talking about. The difference between what's essential and what's non-essential. The essentialist and the non-essentialist. And it's a book worth reading not only once, but twice, multiple times. So you have the lessons deep inside you, realizing the powerful pursuit of less. And it doesn't mean that you pursue less necessarily, less things, it might mean that, but it means that you're laser focused on the things that matter most. And the expenditure of energy is oftentimes meted out that you're spending lots of energy on a lot of little things. And that same energy, when focused on the real things, on the most essential things, on the most important things, you'll be able to accomplish far more. It's just recalculating the things that matter most. And to become an essentialist is to really contemplate, what are those things in your lives? What are your goals? What's your character? What do you stand for? What means the most to you? And if the things that mean the most to you are not the things that you're spending most of your time doing, so like maybe it's time to recalculate that. Like your wife, your husband, your children, your grandchildren. People will say, that's my family's the most important thing. Meanwhile, you spend the least amount of time with your spouse, with your children, with your grandchildren, with your family. So how would you feel? Would you really describe yourself as an essentialist? If that's really true, the answer is no. So the pursuit of trying to appreciate what it means to be an essentialist, Essentialism, Greg McKeown, get it, Google it. You have to have it. It's essential. You must, essential to have the book of Essentialism. It's a great book. Certainly very impactful to me in my life. And I think you'll benefit from that as well. So in the 17th chapter of this book, he has a section called The Power of Small Wins. And The Power of Small Wins is a very impactful chapter, he quotes Doug Feuerbach, who says that every day you do something that will inch you closer to a better tomorrow. Very powerful quote. That's true. That's the idea of positivity. What I do today, it's going to impact tomorrow, and tomorrow's tomorrow, and tomorrow's tomorrow, etc. You get the point. But the realization of the small wins that make all the difference. You don't have to do big things. It's the small things that sometimes make the most awful things happen and the most terrible decline and decay of society. But it's also the power of small wins. So I just want to share with you from what is an incredible example of where we see small wins literally can change a society. And if we were to institute just even this idea, but to think about what are the unique, singular, or personal ideas like this idea, you can't imagine how much this has a tremendous and permanent impact on the world and the people around us. So let's share this idea. So he says the following. So if you think for a moment, when's the last time you were pulled over by the police while driving? You ever have that feeling? You know, the sirens, the lights are flashing behind you and your heart is thumping. You're nervous. Do I have my insurance card? Do I have my registration? Do I have my driver's license? What did I do? Like, what's going to be? You know, you talk about like really having a pachad moment, a fearful moment. Do you ever remember that? When's the last time you were pulled over? Did you ever wonder to yourself, is this going to be a good ticket or a bad ticket? So it's not likely that you thought about that. Everybody knows that tickets are all bad, right? Like, that's what we know. If you're pulled over, then I can say, yay, yasher koach on, wow, I love your posture as you're driving your car. Or, wow, great job. When you were turning right, you put your blinker on. Well done. Or you yielded at the yield sign, or you made it and came to a complete stop when you were driving your car. No, when you get pulled over, you're not getting a yasher koach, a great job, job well done. The officer's not wasting his time. He's not wasting your time. He's not going to tell you something good. He's going to tell you something bad, right? When you think about it, all you do in the neuroplasticity of what your mind brings you to is you think about the negative experiences that you had and the reason why you were pulled over. Good. Everybody knows the tickets are bad, right? No. So listen to this. At least one innovative police precinct, writes Greg McCowan in his great book, in Richmond, Canada, not Richmond, Virginia, Richmond, Canada, thinks this is an assumption that ought to be challenged. Here goes. There is a well-established approach to cracking down on crime. Pass new and harsher laws, set stronger sentencing, or initiate zero tolerance initiatives, right? Think about what's going on in the world today. You know what's going to happen? Harsher laws, stricter sentencing. In other words, you know, do more of what we already do, but only do it more forcefully, right? That's what's going on in the world today, right? Do things more forcefully and then we'll be able to, like, you know, rein people in. So think about this. In other words, if you think about that and how that's literally been so pervasive in society, and look what's happening. It's utter chaos. Maybe that's not working. You know? So for years, this is an incredible suggestion. If only the government would spend some money investing in this project, I wonder if the world would be a greater place. I'm actually going to go so far as to say, the world would be a greater place. Listen to this. For years, the Richmond Police Department followed these core and long-held practices of policing. You know, the policing system everywhere and experienced the typical results. Recidivism rates at 65% and spiraling youth crime. Think about, like, underprivileged, you know, areas where the poverty areas are very, very high, that there's recidivism, those who are coming out of prison, go back to prison. 65%, that's a huge number. Youth crime spiraling. And that is until a young, forward-thinking new superintendent by a fellow by the name of Ward Clapham, C-L-A-P-H-A-M. You can Google him, find out about him. Great. Great initiative. He came in, and he challenged the police department. He literally challenged the whole system. Imagine you're like a little whippersnapper, young guy, and you say, you know what? As you've been doing it, don't do it like this anymore. He asked them, why do all of our policing efforts have to be so reactive, so negative, so after the fact? You ever think about that? Like, you're only doing policing like after the sin, after the infraction, after the negativity. What happens, he said, instead of just focusing on catching criminals after and serving up even harsher punishments after they committed the crime, what happens if the police devoted significant resources and effort to eliminating criminal behavior before it happens? Whoa, like light bulb. What a great idea. To quote Tony Blair, what if they could be tough on crime, but also tough on the causes of crime. You see, it's not just enough to be tough on crime. Like, nobody's saying, and this is the lawlessness, this is what's so foolish about what's happening in the world today. Like, people are now, you're talking about, you know, lawlessness and ruthlessness. Nobody's saying you shouldn't crack down on crime. And you see, the fact that they have it so backwards, there's more crime now about what's happening in New York City and the state of New York and various places around the country, around the world, frankly. There's more crime, there's more chaos than ever before. Nobody's suggesting you shouldn't be tough on crime. But maybe what would be a good suggestion is to think about what is the cause of crime. Like, what happens? And maybe if you spent money, time, effort, and energy battling the cause on crime, maybe the reality would be a little bit different. Out of these questions came the novel idea for something called positive tickets. It's a real thing, friends. It's called Positive Tickets, a program whereby the police, instead of focusing on catching young people perpetrating crimes, would focus on catching youth doing something good. Something as simple as throwing litter away in a trash bin, rather on the ground, wearing a helmet while riding a bike, skateboarding in a designated area, or getting to school on time. You know what happened? It would give those people, would give them a ticket for positive behavior. Imagine what would happen then, that they would get a ticket for positive behavior. Now think about what the consequence of that is. The ticket, of course, it wouldn't carry a fine, like a parking ticket, but instead would be redeemable for some kind of small reward. Imagine that. You get some type of coupon. You get some type of positive ticket that you're going to now get, you're going to have in your hand. And that positive ticket can be taken to a 7-Eleven, can be taken to a movie theater, can be taken to a gas station, can be taken to the, you know, Winn-Dixie, taken to Publix, taken to Trader Joe's. You can take it anywhere. And it's going to then be, it's not going to be a fine, like a parking ticket, but you're going to get a reward. You get something positive. Free entry to the movies. You're going to be entered into a local youth center. Wholesome activities that also had the bonus of keeping the youth people off the streets and out of trouble. All these troubled youth are going to have a place to go. They're going to feel positive. You know what happens when you change the mindset of somebody? All the positivity, everything changes. We've had so many different times where we've talked about the mind and the power of mind, how what it is that a person thinks literally drives a person to better health, better way of thinking. And now what we're learning is a different contribution to society, whereas that same child, a person is not born evil. And if we believe that they're born evil, let's make every effort to try to see if we can try to change that person's perception. When their realities, is it nurture versus nature? Is it an opportunity for us to then maybe change that narrative? What happens if you take that same child who has a disposition for crime and then you put them into an environment where they can use that same energy, now there's positivity? That's unbelievable. They can rise above the circumstances of even their own life story to then contribute wholesome activities that also has the bonus of keeping these young people that could be wayward, rebellious, worse, off the streets and out of trouble. So how well did this Richmond's unconventional effort do? How well was this received, the effort to reimagine policing work? So here's what's unbelievable. This is what McCowan finds. His research shows that amazingly well. Turns out that it was unbelievable. It was unprecedented. It took some time, but what they did is they invested in this approach as a long-term strategy. And after a decade, after 10 years, one study of a decade of this block of time, a decade of the positive tickets system had found to have reduced recidivism from 65% to 8%. 8%. Did you hear that? 65% over a decade, took some time, to 8%. Think about the crime off the street. People didn't lose their lives. Think about the type of people that are now in the society. It's unbelievable. You might not necessarily think of a police department as a place where you would expect people to express essentialism. But this system of positive tickets, it's a lesson in the practice of effortless execution, whereby you have to work on something, you have to change your mindset a little bit. 65% to 8%. And obviously we can go on and on and on about what that meant to society. We actually don't even know how much it meant to the society. The place went from a place that was maybe one that was unsafe to live. Maybe it's one of the safest places to live. One of the most joyous places to bring up children. It's unbelievable. It's an unbelievable change and shift. It's an unbelievable way of thinking things in a little bit of a different way. And by catching and rewarding people in the midst of small wins, that's how the chapter begins. So this superintendents, his approach, it tapped into the power of celebrating progress. The power of what happens to a person when you feel successful, when you feel good about yourself, when you do something that is even small for yourself. Oh my gosh, when you do something for somebody else, look what happens. You can literally change a town. You can change a world. Forget about police brutality in the sense of policing people in a more intensified way. They're doing it wrong. Of course, there's police brutality that needs to be reined in. What would happen if these police departments reconstituted themselves to find positivity in a different way by catching and by rewarding these small wins? You see that you celebrate progress. In one moving example, a police officer pulled over a teenager who had saved a girl from being hit by a car, gave him a positive ticket and said, "You did a great thing today. You can make a difference." The boy went home. He put the positive ticket on his wall. After a few weeks, his foster mother asked him whether he was going to cash it in. To her surprise, he said he never would. Why? As an adult had told him he could be something. Somebody told him that he could be chashuv, that he could be important. He could be something important to society. That was worth more than a free pizza. That was worth more than a free trip to the movies or bowling. Imagine what happens. Multiply that type of positive interaction by 40,000 times a year for 10 years. And you can sense why it started to make a difference in Richmond. Each time a young person was recognized and commended for doing something good, he or she was that much more motivated to continue doing good until eventually doing good became natural and effortless. And that's the second most important lesson that we have to take care. It's not just simply ourselves to appreciate the negativity of what it is that we do. For sure, we have to realize that. But imagine the positivity. Let's adopt the concept of positive tickets. If only the governments would adopt this concept and help police precincts or even any form of government to think and to focus on positivity, imagine how the world would be different. You multiply times multiply times multiply and imagine the impact that that has, the impression that it has on the world. So here are the two lessons. Again, lesson number one is a chavivus, a love for Eretz Yisrael, a love for our beloved homeland, a love for Eretz Yisrael in a way that we have to now not only surround ourselves around the people, but also be those people that are going to celebrate, to share the story of how beautiful and beloved Eretz Yisrael is. That's Benos Tzalachan, that's the link to Yosef at Tzadik. That's why Moshe chooses Menashe. Why Chatzi Sheva Menashe? Because of the events that took place centuries earlier when he caused his uncles to tear their garments and how unbelievably impactful that event has for generations that would happen, that would follow, and the lesson of what it means for us ourselves to also appreciate that as well. And the story of the positive tickets, essentialism, Greg McCowan, of how the intake recidivism rate from 65 to 8 and how many other variables, statistics, lessons, and contributions to society can be had in an unbelievable way. If we take these lessons to heart and realize that it's the positive things we say, the positive things that we do, the far-reaching repercussions that they have, we can ourselves, with our families, with our communities, family, and friends, make the world a better place. Yim Yirtzeh Hashem, we're going to do so. Kein Yehi Ratzon V'Nomar Amen. And with that, I wish everybody a beautiful day. Everyone should stay healthy and safe and positive, happy and holy. A beautiful day. Meaningful 3 weeks, and a beautiful Shabbos Kodesh. Thank you all for listening in the Zoom room. Thank you all for listening on Facebook Live. I wish you all a beautiful, blessed, and happy day.